Now let's see whether we're recording now. It's not time to say good afternoon, but tell me, just say a word to me and we'll see how your voice is doing.
No, it's still morning. I don't have anything to do until a lunch engagement.
There, I think we're in business again. Well, you got back to New York with 10 cents
yes.
in your pocket.
And then my regiment, which was the 63rd Infantry, was then in New York. It was a regular army regiment, really quite a bunch of very tough guys in it, a lot of lumberjacks. And I had been over on advance duty, and the regiment didn't get over at all. But it was assigned to police guard duty in New York. And so I was assigned back to active service with the regiment and stayed. I couldn't get out for, I guess almost a couple of months. And a couple of times a week I would be officer of the guard or officer of the day from Columbus Circle to the Grand Central Station of the police guard.
What did you have to do?
Well, they were in charge of the military police in that area. And remember, these boys were coming back from overseas and out for a wild time in New York. And it was very entertaining. And they were inclined to say some tough things about these regular army boys who hadn't been overseas for some strange reason. I don't know why that regiment didn't get overseas, but it didn't.
Was it difficult to leave a regular army?
I think the idea was that they didn't know what might happen in this country, and they wanted a few very tough old units at home. And so it was rather typical to put a regiment like that as military police.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. I don't know what was the basis for that decision, but there they were.
I was thinking, too, of that when you were ready to leave the army, was it harder for you to get out?
Oh, no, I got out very... Then they were beginning to disband the army very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I got out, came home to California, and about that time, well, prior to that time, some geological work had been organized in Peru for the Cerro de Pasco Copper Company. Cerro de Pasco Copper Corporation, it was called then, and a well-known geologist who had been on the Geological Survey, John M. Boutwell, B-O-U-T-W-E-L-L, had been engaged as the consulting geologist for the Cerro de Pasco Company, and to organize a geological study of the properties in Peru. And he got the job because he met Edward Clark, the president of the company, in my room at Harvard.
Oh, really?
Edward Clark was the manager of the Hearst estate, which still had a substantial interest in the Cerro de Pasco Company. So it's funny how these things tie together.
Yeah.
And then he offered me a job at the beginning of the war to go to Peru with him, and I couldn't, or turned it down because I went into the army. But when I came out of the army, I accepted that job in Peru. But I came home for a few months before that, and there were other jobs I was considering too, but the Peruvian job was very alluring. And that was the spring that Mrs. Hearst was so ill and died. And I remember the last time I saw her, she said, I knew you were going to decide to go to Peru all the time. So I said goodbye to her. That was the last time I saw her, for she died the next week.
Was this in Pleasanton?
That was in Pleasanton, yes. And then her funeral was in the basement of what's now the Cathedral, Grace Cathedral. It hadn't been completed.
Oh, yes.
I remember I was, I think, a pallbearer then. Moore Stevens died on the cable car on his way home from that funeral.
Oh,
And his funeral was the same week at the Factory Glade. Yes. So that was, then I went off to Peru, I think that was in May, in 1919.
And how was your Spanish at this point? Is that what they
said? My Spanish was zero. I had French and German in college. That's what you had to have for your PhD. Can't say I ever mastered those languages. I could read them enough to get my PhD and meet the language requirements. Went to Peru with practically no Spanish. And, by the time I'd left Peru, I think I was fairly fluent in Spanish. Never very elegant in Spanish. But
Were the people who worked the mine Indians mostly?
Yes, the technical staff in those days was largely American and English. And the miners were mostly the Peruvian Indians, they called them, up in the high country. The mines are all very high in the Andes. Cerro de Pasco itself is at 14,200 feet.
Is there an oxygen problem at that?
Oh, yes. Nearly everyone going up is decidedly uncomfortable. It may range from just being uncomfortable to being very, very ill with, it's called soroche, S-I-O-R-C-H-E. S-I-O-R-C-H-E. It's the mountain sickness.
I see.
And it has been established now that after you've been up in the high altitude for a while, you build up a much higher blood count of the red corpuscles, and then you feel fairly normal. In fact, that initial work was done by a very distinguished group of American and English doctors who came down while I was still at Cerro de Pasco as a geologist, and Barcroft, I think he was knighted for his work, was in charge of it. They had a couple of three baggage cars on the railroad fitted up as laboratories and made tests of the Indians and tests of the Americans who were living up there. Mm. And so I was one of Barcroft's guinea pigs. And the mountain in the University of California's high altitude station in the White Mountains on the east side of the Sierra Nevada is Mount Barcroft, named after this Barcroft.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm. And after they were reaching the end of their studies on this, we told them we were going to put on a controlled experiment to study the effects of alcohol and dancing at 14,000 feet. We had a whale of a party, which the doctors all intended. They actually did make tests afterwards.
That's a lovely experiment.
It was. I've forgotten just that year, probably it was around 20 or 21, I've forgotten just what that year was.
Were you dealing at all with the national government in Peru?
No. The company held its titles and so on under the Peruvian law, mm-hmm. and I was much too far down the ranks ever to have any particular dealings with the government officials.
With the geological problems similar to those in Alaska?
No, well, there's a certain similarity all through the field of metalliferous deposits, but they were quite unique deposits in many ways. It was a great area in which very, very little geological work had been done, and so it was a beautiful opportunity to wade into a new field, something like the old geologists who came out here in the West in the early days.
Yes.
So,
I just wanted to just see if I understood how Cerro de Pasco was set up. It was a Peruvian?
The district was an old district that had been worked since colonial times. I think the earliest ore mined there was silver, back about 1630 or some time of that sort by the Spaniards. And they were not interested in copper at all. And they did find some very rich silver ores at Cerro de Pasco. And then that gradually declined until there was very little activity in Cerro de Pasco, except this rabbit warren type of burrows in the ground, looking for high-grade silver. Then some English companies or people came in to mine, to work the high-grade copper ores underneath this capping of silver ores. And Trevithick, the famous engineer who made so many steam engines for pumping in mines, I think he went down there himself, and they packed huge, heavy machinery up from the coast. There were no roads at all. The railroad hadn't been built then. They must have packed it on long poles and men's backs, and installed a steam engine and a Cornish pump up there. I think this goes back into the 20s. And unfortunately, that has disappeared, though. I think I saw some fragments of that old engine. The mine, after you got down to a depth of about 300 feet, was very wet. There was so much water in it that without machinery, you couldn't pump and get deeper. So then things stopped there for a long time. Then a tunnel was driven in from a nearby canyon that got them down to 400 feet, which isn't very far down. And some rich copper ores were mined then. And that went on in a small way, but little activity going on for years, until about around the turn of the century, when an American syndicate was formed. It was really organized, started by a promoter named McCune, M-C-C-U-N-E, who put together a lot of the claims up there, got control of them, and then presented them to an American syndicate. And that syndicate happened to include J.B. Hagen,
Oh, yes. You
see, of the Hearst Group.
I see.
And Hearst was dead then, but Edward Clark put the Phoebe Hearst estate into this enterprise on a somewhat minor way. It was a fairly large syndicate put up the money, and they by that time the Meigs, the railroad had been built from Lima. That was built in, I think, in the 70s by Meigs. Meigs was the city treasurer, I think, of San Francisco, and got out by the skin of his teeth. He was, I think, going to be jailed for something or other, and went to Peru and organized this railroad. He's a historical figure here in San Francisco.
Oh, that's lovely.
You may have heard of Meigs Wharf.
Yes.
That was
that Meigs. That's right.
Well, he was not an engineer. He was just the promoter of the railroad. And I shouldn't know the name of the engineer, but that slipped my mind.
And it was called the Lima Railroad, or the...
Well, it was called the Ferrocarril Central de Peru, the Central Railroad of Peru. And it went from Lima up into the Andes and stopped for a long time before it got across the top, and then was finally built across the top of the mountains and on down to a town called Huancayo, way back in the plateau country. And the Cerro de Pasco Company then built a railroad from a little town called Oroya, O-R-O-Y-A, on this Central Railroad of Peru up to the district of Cerro de Pasco. To the north, mostly a railroad built up the plateau.
Must have been an enormous difficulty.
Well, it was, and they built a smelter up there too. and started in mining some quite rich ores of copper. And then the war came, and with copper prices took a big jump. And they made a lot of, that made Cerro a very profitable company. And then it's grown and grown since then, until it's one of the great companies of Peru. And they, not only did they have the Cerro de Pasco district, but a little later they got a district right on the very crest of the Andes called Morococha, M-O-R-O-C-H-A. And built a new smelter down at Arroyo, which is still going. And in the course of the following years, they acquired a great many other properties too that are tributary to this smelter at Arroyo. And in those years I was down there, 6 years, I started as a geologist in Cerro de Pasco itself, and then became the chief geologist for the whole corporation, all their operations in Peru, organized their exploration work and the development work in the mines and so on. Great fun.
Weren't you a very young man to have such
Well, I'd had the war, you see, then, so I was, let's see, how old was I?
Been under 30 still?
Oh, yes, I think I went down there, I was about 27. Mm-hmm. And left, I was down there 6 years. And while I probably might have been there the rest of my life, but there was a professorship of mining engineering open. The professor had retired or died, and I think largely due to the influence of Grattan, that full professorship was offered to me.
Oh,
at, I guess I was in, let's see, that. I guess I was about 33 or 34 then. So I couldn't resist a full professorship at Harvard, so I went back. I think I was the youngest full professor at Harvard at that time.
Imagine, of course, and you hadn't had to go up the ladder.
Either. No, so I hopped.
Yes, you
over
did.
All the ranks.
Oh, that's just marvelous.
Which is a wonderful way. That's why I never had any worries about academic succession.
No.
I thought they took an awful chance, which they did. They shouldn't do those things, but...
Before we leave Cerro de Pasco, I would love to just hear a little bit more about the life there and what a geologist does for a mining concern.
It was really in the early the days I was in Cerro de Pasco in the early 20s. It was a very remote place. It was 2 weeks to get down by steamer. It was a very hard day or 2 days up the railroad to the mine, and you were in quite an isolated community up there, living at a very high altitude. We had a series of rather nice little cottages for the American employees. Most of the Peruvian employees lived in the town of Cerro de Pasco, which was somewhat picturesque, but really a pretty horrible little town up at that high altitude. Mm-hmm. The area, something like the high, some of the bare parts of Wyoming with high mountains, but not very impressive in relation to the plateau, just not as rough as the Berkeley Hills, really, above the level of the plateau, except off in the distance. You could see the western wall of the Andes just going up, some of the peaks going up to 20,000 feet, a great series of snow-covered peaks, magnificent sight really, over this rolling high plateau. So for anybody who liked open country and mountains, it was really a very thrilling place. In those days, geology was rather finding itself as a tool to use in mining operations, but as we worked it out, the geologists and I was built up a staff down there, would not only map the surface and the distribution of the rocks and formations, but also map the successive levels of the mine, so that you would see where the ore bodies were going, where the veins or where the larger replacement ore bodies were going, with the expectation that with that information accurately plotted on mines, the ore would be mined much more completely, and you wouldn't dilute it by mining waste, and also that you would make your plans for deeper levels more wisely and in relation to the best projections or guesses you could make about what was going to be encountered when you went down, say, another couple hundred feet. That mine hasn't turned out to be a very deep mine. I don't think they're gone down much more than 2,300 feet. The ore has become rather disappointing down there, but it turned out it started with very rich copper ores, and then it developed some very fine veins of copper ores that went down, and a huge body of lead, zinc, and silver ore, great masses of that, which were gradually developed as the mine was explored. And now again that's turned into an open pit mine, where a big area that had been originally honeycombed with old Spanish workings for silver was stripped in a pit, and that oxidized ore was treated for the low-grade silver in it. Then that exposed a great mass of sulfide ore in depth, which has been mined in an open pit. It's very, very different from the copper mines called the porphyry coppers. This was a great massive body of sulfides, such as with great tonnages of pyrite and scattered bits of the copper minerals and lead and zinc sulfides in it. And from a metallurgical standpoint, there was a very great problem to concentrate and separate these metals from such a type of ore. It was a very difficult metallurgical problem, which has been pretty well solved. So that mine is still running in the deeper ores, but also there's quite a tonnage being mined from an open pit there.
I didn't realize that a mine goes through certain phases.
It really does, and at any one time you wonder how long the mine's going to live. You've got ore blocked out, as we say, that you've found, you've measured, you know what it is. Usually it might be 5 or 6 years, and you'd have all that ore mined out, but you keep finding new ore. So that mine is still going on. And there are other big mines that they've had too are still going on. So several, while I don't know what their ore reserves are today, they're probably very much larger than they were when I was down there as a young fellow. We couldn't have predicted with certainty that it was going to go on for more than a half dozen or a dozen years at most. That's 50 years ago. It's still going.
Remarkable. So then the metal or the refined ore was shipped?
Yes, that the some of the ore was so rich that it was shipped in railroad cars, first to the old smelter, which was about 15, 20 miles away, or I guess less than that, about 10 miles, where it was smelted, that is, melted up, and a product called blister copper was made, which is an impure copper which contains all the silver and the gold as well as copper. So it's a very valuable product. And then the blister copper was shipped in great slabs up to the United States for refining.
Where would it come then, to this Louisiana?
That went up to an electrolytic refinery at Perth Amboy, opposite New York, of the American Metal Company. And then that original smelter was scrapped while I was down there. A new smelter was built at Arroyo. And the higher grade ores were being...
Do you smell smoke?
Yes, I do. That's from this, I don't believe. Oh, it's probably Something burning outside.
Oh, yes. Well, this, all of this handling and shipping must be very costly, isn't it?
Yes, you're surprised they can make copper and sell it so cheaply as they do.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are big concentrating plants at Cerro de Pasco and the other mines themselves that take the lower grade ore and make a higher sulfide concentrate, and then that is shipped to the smelter. Smelting is a very expensive process. You don't want to. You can't use a smelter to treat low grade ores. You have to concentrate those ores first, and then ship the concentrates.
Mm-hmm.
And the concentrates are shipped to Arroyo and then treated. It's a very, very elaborate plant, which turns out not only copper, lead, zinc, bismuth, gold, silver.
Mm-hmm.
The ores down there are complex, and they are valuable for a great many different metals. The old Cerro de Pasco district really started as a silver district by the Spaniards, and all the canyons around there are filled with these so-called patios, sort of stone circular tank-like structures in which the silver ore was thrown with some salt and a little copper sulfate. Horses were used to stir it up, and great stones were, wheels were rolled around it to crush it, and the silver was extracted that way. Everything else was wasted. Then mercury was thrown in to catch the silver that was liberated. And that was probably for a couple of hundred years of the chief product of Cerro de Pasco. Then it turned to the high-grade copper ores for a short time, and then lower grade copper ores. Now it's the lower grade copper ores and huge bodies of lead, zinc, and silver ore that are mined.
Now,
so it's had quite a transition.
Yes, immensely so. Well, as you describe your work as a geologist, I take it that the metallurgy was handled by other specialists.
Yes, the metallurgy, there'd be a metallurgical department, and then a mining, the actual operations of the mine would be under the mining engineers who were involved in the design and the operation of the shafts and the layout and the breaking of the ore and hoisting it and all that. So the geology was concerned largely with the finding of new ore and the appraisal of the ore that had been found. Mm-hmm. And then the exploration, too, out into other districts up and down the Andes to acquire additional properties for this big smelter. That was, in some ways, exploration was great fun. Because in those days, it was horseback.
Left
the railroad, there were practically no motor roads.
Would you have a whole little a train of horses?
Party? You'd go out with a field party. Usually, you could live on the country. You didn't could live in these mountain villages. And
uh-huh.
They'd have little mutton, eggs, and chickens, and some raw, pretty heavy wheat bread. You didn't have to take very much long. It was primitive life. It wasn't too bad.
But that didn't seem to bother you.
No, I survived pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And so you did some of this exploring, I take it?
Yes, I liked that part of it myself. And I was out on a number of trips. Mm-hmm. Saw some districts become, or will become, great mines, too. Still to be developed.
Oh, I see. So you would just keep records of what you saw?
Oh, yes, that's all in the Cerro records. And mm-hmm. Those were initial studies made of some of the properties they've subsequently acquired. And, of course, I suppose there were a lot of them we looked at didn't amount to anything, too.
Well, when you are looking at, say, unbroken ground, are there certain indications that would suggest to you that this is a
likely spot? Oh, yes. These ore deposits are very unusual things, and there are signs at the surface. Of course, the conspicuous ones where you get bright green and blue stains are easily recognized. Many of these deposits will have a lot of iron in them, so you get a rather conspicuous iron staining colors around on the surface. Some of these low-grade iron deposits, sulfides, are not too valuable unless there's copper or lead or zinc or silver associated with them. Well, our techniques were pretty primitive 50 years ago compared to what they do now, and their studying of trace minerals and geophysics and a lot of other devices that are used, but by and large they were fairly effective too.
Were you helped much by water movement, stream beds, and this sort of thing, or is that not important in copper
exploration? That's not particularly important in copper. It is in gold, because gold is so indestructible that it tends to accumulate in streams the way it did in California. So you get a poor man's sort of gold in the gravels, which you can just wash out with a pan, and that you can trace that back to its source in deposits like the Californian deposits, but there was not very much of that in Peru, though some. Probably that's what the Inca gold came from, but no great gold mines, really. First-rate gold mines have been developed in Peru, strangely enough.
As a geologist, did you feel that you should understand all of the operations of the mine, or wasn't that essential to you?
Well, when you're living in a community like that, you get familiar with what's going on, though you may not be an expert in those other fields. So the geological road is a very good road to follow toward higher administrative posts in mining. Mm-hmm. As if a man wants to be primarily a geologist, who says, I'm just not interested in anything except geologists, he'll stay in geology, which get a living out of it, but it isn't going to be a very rewarding life. Later I ended up, you see, going back to Peru from Berkeley in the 40s as manager of the whole show.
Yes, what a
so
pattern.
It was rather an interesting transition that way.
Very. What did you do for reading material?
We had a little library up there in Cerro de Pasco, and in those days most of the technical people would bring some of their own books down.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very different from academic work. You don't have library facilities. You really are out seeing things in the field on your own.
Yeah. It's
and,
a different life.
Designing. Instead of speculating, writing papers about something, you put down drill holes, find out what there is.
Were there families, American and English families living there?
Yes, I should say about three quarters of the people were married down there. Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me a grim place for family life. The altitude, I think, bothered the women more than the men, and it was, I think, a very bad place at that high altitude for young children.
Nice.
In fact, when there was a baby expected in the family, the doctors insisted the wife go down to Lima and have the baby down at sea level, but they came back again with these youngsters.
Okay.
But it's that high altitude is not easy. It's a strain on anybody.
Mm-hmm. Did you get into Lima very often?
Well, everybody was supposed to take a vacation every 6 months then, for 2 weeks, to go down to the low country. I remember my first vacation, I rode horseback down to the coast over the mountains because I just wanted to see the geology, so a postman's holiday.
That sounds very strenuous.
Yes. Later, when I was down there as manager, I was living in Lima, and then there was a motor road up to Arroyo, and I could leave the office in Lima at 3 in the afternoon and cross a pass almost at 16,000 feet and be at my house in Arroyo for dinner, say at 8 o'clock that night. But going back and forth was pretty strenuous too. Though the altitude, and I got used to it, didn't bother me much.
That's really interesting. What sort of a city was Lima at that time?
Lima was then much more of a colonial city. It was much smaller, way over a million people now. I don't much larger than San Francisco. Mm. Old Lima, the old core of Lima, which was still the center of Lima with its rather decrepit colonial period hotels and the nice old churches, was charming, but old colonial city. Now it's become, of course, a great metropolis and surrounded by suburbs of sort of a mixture of Mediterranean, Californian style, with the, it's all irrigated. There's practically no rain in Lima at all. All the vegetation comes from irrigation coming off these streams in the Andes. But you have beautiful gardens and really quite a lovely city. And of course now with big modern hotels.
And did you find that the Mayan people, did they mingle with the residents in Lima?
In those days, not very much. They kept very much to themselves. The older families and the richer people in Lima were pretty, they had their own lives and rather snobbish. Mm-hmm. Ways.
Spanish pattern of
yes,
living.
Mm-hmm. And unless you had some definite introductions to those people, you really didn't see very much of them. The average mining man in those early days in Peru really didn't become very close to the what you might call Lima society. Though I had some friends there and got around a little bit, but I liked Lima very much. When I was later down there as manager, of course, I had a very wide acquaintance in Lima.
Yes.
Then, of course, in those days, of course, later, I had many associations with the high officials in Lima and many close friends. One of my old friends down there was Pedro Beltran, who was he became Prime Minister of Peru and is the owner of La Prensa, the chief, one of the major papers there. And he married a San Francisco girl, Miriam Kropp, K-R-O-P-P, who was a Stanford girl. And Miriam Kropp and Marion Sproul, Bob Sproul's daughter, went down to Lima for jobs in the embassy during the Second War, while I was down there with the Cerro de Pasco Company as a vice president and general manager. So I saw the two girls pretty often down there. And Marion married a chap in the embassy down there, and Miriam, we called her Croppy, married my old friend Pedro Beltran,
I see.
Who became ambassador and was ambassador later in Washington. Mm-hmm. So I think he was ambassador before he was married.
Well, these old associations keep.
Yes, so they're still very close friends of mine. And many are down there, but I'm getting way ahead of the game. This is part of the Cerro de Pasco story.
Yes, that's right. There is certainly a link. Well, however you like to discuss this, should we get you back to being the youngest full professor at Harvard?
That didn't last very long, because I'm sure there was somebody younger than I appointed. Well, I got older.
Of course, you took care of the whole thing.
Yes. So that time...
Were you a professor, were you a professor of geology?
No, I was a professor of mining engineering for a few years, and then we decided that... Became apparent, I think, that mining engineering was dying on the vine at Harvard, and so I became professor of mining geology, which, after all, was my field. And instead of being a member of the engineering school, then I became a member of the geological department in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we planned it that way at the beginning, anyhow.
I see.
So then I became quite a while chairman of the department of geology and geography at Harvard. So I was there for about 16 years.
Well, now you left Peru and you went then to?
Cambridge.
To Cambridge.
Now I was married that year to a girl who lived in Kenilworth, Illinois. That's just outside of Chicago. Eleanor Eckhart, E-C-K-H-A-R-T. Her family were rather prominent in Chicago.
Were they mining people?
No. I think the family fortune came from milling, and her father was a lawyer in a well-known firm in Chicago. And so I was married the same year I went to Harvard. Mm-hmm. So I was 16 years at Harvard, which seemed a lifetime.
Goodness, that is long. Did you have children then?
Yes, that's two children, Donald McLaughlin Jr. and Charles, and they grew up in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why. Of course, Charlie then wouldn't go to Harvard because he'd grown up there, and I was pulling for Princeton, so he went to Yale. I called him the black sheep of the family, but he ended up taking his PhD at Harvard.
That's all very familiar, isn't it?
And my boy Don enlisted, he was Exeter then, but he enlisted in the Navy at 17, and his eyes were not too good. He didn't get a commission, so he went through the War of the Pacific as a seaman. Came out a very tough-minded individual, and he wouldn't go back east, so I was in Berkeley then. No, I was living in Berkeley, but not on the faculty. So he came back and started in civil engineering here and shifted to geology and took a master's degree in Berkeley.
Now, let's see, is your son Charles also a
geologist? No, he's in history.
Oh.
And he's in American University in Washington now.
Well, was it hard to get accustomed to campus life after the Andes?
Was a little bit, but it all seemed coming back to almost a home base because, of course, I've been at Harvard for 3 years when I was a graduate student.
And I suppose many faculty members were there still.
Oh, yes, practically all my old faculty people. It wasn't such a long time, you see.
No, just 6 years.
From 17 to 25.
Oh, yes.
6 years.
Oh, yeah.
And then the first summer, my Sarah DePasco friends wanted me to come back to Sarah DePasco as a consultant for the summer. But at that time, Edward Clark, who was then president both of Sarah DePasco and the Homestake Mining Company, wanted me to go out to make a geological study of the Homestake, as he said he thought the Homestake was through, finished. They'd had some bad luck in some of their initial, they hadn't gone to the right places. They were going down. They thought the ore bodies were ending. Well, Homestake's still going on.
Well, I love the way you say they hadn't gone to the right places. That's the whole trick, isn't it?
Really is.
How you know the right places?
Well, it takes a lot of very careful, detailed work to really get the right places. And so I went out in the summer of 26 to Leeds, South Dakota, spent the summer at the Homestake and really organized the geological work there on a new basis, built up a very good staff for Homestake.
Was this your first exposure to Homestake?
I'd been out there when I was a sophomore or a junior in Berkeley, just for a summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd been out there again on another short visit too. But I'd had nothing to do. I was just a student. This was my first engagement by Homestake in 1926. And so I didn't go back to Peru. That turned me to Homestake. And so all the summers after that were devoted to Homestake or to the San Luis mine down in Mexico, which was of mine, that the Hearsts, and they still had a big interest in that, though they have no had no interest in Homestake at all.
Oh, I see.
In 26, their entire interest was sold out after Phoebe Hearst's death. So it's rather funny that I should go back to Homestake after the Hearst family was out of it entirely.
Well, you seem to link up a lot of things in your own
mind.
It
is rather strange how these things tie together.
What sort of mine is the San Luis?
San Luis is a quite a high-grade silver-gold mine in from Mazatlan. And in the early days you had to go in by trail. And when I went down first, we went in from the Southern Pacific Railroad, a 2 days trip into a terrific canyon back in the in the mountains. It was a hard trip, and now there's a landing field in that down in the canyon, about like the Grand Canyon, you land down there. So those two consulting connections kept me very busy in the summertime. And Harvard was pretty tolerant about your consulting work. I had some New York, a very interesting firm in New York, Case Pomeroy and Company, asked if I wanted me to act as their consulting geologist. So I was down in New York quite a, well, about a day a week with them. I remember Jim Collins said he thought that these more or less world widely scattered activities made me a much better teacher in the field which I was teaching, which I think was true.
I think so too.
Though I didn't really publish very much. Few papers occasionally, but I'm sure the Berkeley faculty would never have promoted me. Then I did have a full professor.
You were there.
I didn't have to worry about it.
Well, when you went on your consulting tasks, let's say especially during the summer, did you bring along some of your more promising students?
Yes. Generally, I'd get some of these, get them for jobs, or even some of them would do a thesis on some of these properties. And in fact, the president of the Homestake, and he's now become chairman of the board succeeding me, was John Gustafson, who was a student of mine at Harvard, who went out and did his thesis on the Homestake. And their chief geologist was also a student from Harvard, Jim Noble. And Paul Henshaw, who's now president of Homestake, was one of my tutees at Harvard.
Oh.
So you learn who these bright boys are, get them jobs, the first thing you know you're working together.
I see. Well, it's very nice for them too to have a friend.
In fact, there was a lot of Harvard boys went down to Cerro de Pasco. We used to have what we call the Cerro de Pasco Alumni Association.
I like that. I think we're coming again near the end.
Well, I don't want to use up all your tape and your time this morning.
Well, your time is far more to the point. I think we'll just let the last little bit run out. We're getting into such fascinating material.
Well, I'm afraid I'm hopping all over the lot, probably.
Well, this is not at all a bad way to do it, and there is a certain logic in it, but as, you know, when the material is transcribed,
yes,
we can just move pages. There's no problem at all. And I think sometimes when a thought comes into your mind, better say it, because it might not come again.
Yes, yes. It is surprising the thing.